This idea that you're teaching, not policing, makes the tone a lot gentler in France. When Leo refuses to use his silverware at dinner, I try to imagine that I'm teaching him to use a fork, much like I teach him a letter of the alphabet. This makes it easier for me to be patient and calm. I no longer feel disrespected and angry when he doesn't immediately comply. And with some of the stress off the situation, he's more amiable about trying. I don't yell, and dinner is more pleasant for everyone. It takes me a while to realize that French and American parents also use the word strict quite differently. When Americans describe someone as strict, they typically mean that the person has an all-encompassing authority. The image of a stern, joyless schoolteacher comes to mind. I don't know many American parents who use this word to describe themselves, but almost all the French parents I know do. French parents, however, mean something different than American parents do when they call themselves strict. They mean that they're very strict about a few things and pretty relaxed about everything else. That's the cadre model, a firm frame surrounding a lot of freedom.
We shall leave the child as free as possible, without imposing useless rules on him, Françoise Dolto says in The Major Stages of Childhood. We should leave him only the cadre of rules that are essential for his security, and he'll understand from experience when he tries to transgress that they are essential and that we don't do anything just to bother him.
In other words, being strict about a few key things makes parents seem more reasonable and thus makes it more likely that children will obey. True to Dolto's spirit, middle-class Parisian parents tell me that they usually don't get worked up about minor bêtises, those small acts of naughtiness. They assume that these are just part of being a kid.
I think if every misbehavior is treated on the same level, how will they know what's important? My friend Esther tells me.
But these same parents say that they immediately jump on certain types of infractions. Their zero-tolerance areas vary, but almost all the parents I know say that their main non-negotiable realm is respect for others. They're referring to all those bonjours, au revoirs, and mercis, and also about speaking respectfully to parents or other adults. Physical aggression is another common no-go area. American kids often seem to get away with hitting their parents, even though they know they're not supposed to. The French adults I know don't tolerate this at all. Bean hits me once in front of our neighbor Pascal, a bohemian 50-ish bachelor. Pascal is normally an easygoing guy, but he immediately launches into a stern lecture about how one does not do that. I'm awed by his sudden conviction. I can see that Bean is awed, too. At bedtime, you can really see the French balance between being very strict about a few things and very relaxed about most others. A few parents tell me that at bedtime, their kids must stay in their rooms, but within their rooms, they can do what they want. I introduce this concept to Bean, and she really likes it. She doesn't focus on the fact that she's confined to her room. Instead, she keeps saying proudly, "I can do whatever I want." She usually plays or reads for a while, then puts herself to bed. When the boys are about 2 and they're sleeping in beds rather than cribs, I introduce this same principle. Since they're sharing a room, things tend to get a bit more boisterous. I hear a lot of crashing Legos. Unless it sounds dangerous, however, I avoid going back in after I've said goodnight. Sometimes, if it's getting late and they're still going strong, I come in and tell them that it's bedtime and that I'm turning off the lights. They don't seem to view this as a violation of the do-what-you-want principle. By that point, they're usually exhausted and they climb into bed. To pry myself further out of my black-and-white way of looking at authority, I visit Danielle Marcelli. Marcelli is head of child psychiatry at a large hospital in Poitiers and the author of more than a dozen books, including a recent one called Il est permis d'obéir. It is permissible to obey. The book is meant for parents, but typically, it's also a meditation on the nature of authority. Marcelli develops his arguments in long expositions, quoting Hannah Arendt and delighting in paradoxes. His favorite paradox is that in order for parents to have authority, they should say yes most of the time,
If you always forbid, you're authoritarian, Marcella tells me over coffee and chocolates. He says the main point of parental authority is to authorize children to do things, not to block them. Marcella gives the example of a child who wants an orange, or a glass of water, or to touch a computer. He says the current French liberal education dictates that the child should ask before touching or taking these things. Marcelli approves of this asking, but he says the parent's response should almost always be yes. Parents should only forbid him every once in a while because it's fragile or dangerous, but fundamentally the parent's job is to teach the child to ask before taking. Marcelli says that embedded in this dynamic is a longer-term goal with its own paradox. If all is done right, the child will eventually reach a point where he can choose to disobey too. The sign of a successful education is to teach a child to obey until he can freely authorize himself to disobey from time to time. Because can one learn to disobey certain orders if one has not learned to obey? Submission demeans, Marcelli explains, whereas obedience allows a child to grow up. He also says that children should watch a bit of television so they have a shared culture with other kids. To follow Marcelli's whole argument about authority, it would help to have been raised in France, where philosophy is taught in high school. What I do understand is that part of the point of building such a firm cadre for kids is that they can sometimes leave the cadre, and it will be there when they get back. Marcelli is echoing another point I've heard a lot in France. Without limits, kids will be consumed by their own desires. By nature, a human being knows no limits, Marcelli tells me. French parents stress the cadre because they know that without boundaries, children will be overpowered by these desires. The cadre helps to contain all this inner turmoil and calm it down. That could explain why my children are practically the only ones having tantrums in the park in Paris. A tantrum happens when a child is overwhelmed by his own desires and doesn't know how to stop himself. The other kids are used to hearing no and having to accept it. Mine aren't. My no feels contingent and weak to them. It doesn't stop the chain of wanting. Marcelli says that kids with a cadre can absolutely be creative and awakened, a state that French parents also describe as blossoming. The French ideal is to promote the child's blossoming within the cadre. He says a small minority of French parents think that blossoming is the only important thing and don't build any cadre for their kids. It's pretty clear how Marcelli feels about this latter group. Their children, he says, don't do well at all and despair in every sense. I'm quite taken with this new view. From now on, I'm determined to be authoritative, but not authoritarian. When I'm putting Bean to bed one evening, I tell her that I know she needs to do bêtises sometimes. She looks relieved. It's a moment of complicity.
Can you tell that to Daddy? She asks.
Bean, who, after all, spends her days in a French school, has a better grasp of discipline than I do. One morning, I'm in the lobby of our apartment building. Simon is traveling. I'm alone with the kids, and we're running late. I need the boys to get into the stroller so I can rush Bean to school and then take them to the creche. But the boys refuse to get into their double stroller. They want to walk, which will take even longer. What's more, we're in the courtyard of our building, so the neighbors can hear and even watch this whole exchange. I summon whatever pre-coffee authority I can muster and insist that they get in. This has no effect. Bean has been watching me, too. She clearly believes that I should be able to galvanize two little boys.
Just say 1, 2, 3,
she says with considerable irritation. Apparently, this is what her teachers say when they want an uncooperative child to comply. Saying 1, 2, 3 isn't rocket science. Some American parents certainly say it too. But the logic behind it is very French. This gives him some time, and it's respectful to the child, Daniel Marcelli says. The child should be allowed to play an active role in obeying, which requires giving him time to respond. In It Is Permissible to Obey, Marcelli gives the example of a child who seizes a sharp knife. His mother looks at him and says to him, her face cold, her tone firm and neutral, her eyebrows lightly furrowed, "Put that down."
In this example, the child looks at his mother but doesn't move. 15 seconds later, his mother adds in a firmer tone,
"You put it down right away."
And then 10 seconds later,
"Do you understand?"
In Marcelli's telling, the little boy then puts the knife on the table.
The mother's face relaxes, her voice becomes sweeter, and she says to him, "That's good." Then she explains to him that it's dangerous and that you can cut yourself with a knife.
Marcelli notes that although the child was obedient in the end, he was also an active participant. There was reciprocal respect.
The child has obeyed. His mother thanks him, but not excessively. Her child recognizes her authority. For this to happen, there must be words, time, patience, and reciprocal recognition. If his mother had rushed over to him and snatched the knife from his hands, he wouldn't have understood much of anything.
It's hard to strike this balance between being the boss, but also listening to a child and respecting him. One afternoon, as I'm getting Joey dressed to lead the creche, he suddenly collapses in tears. I'm all charged up in my new "it's me who decides" mode. I have the fervor of a convert. I decide that this is like the incident with Adrian on the doctor's scale. I'm going to force him to get dressed. But Fatima, his favorite caregiver at the creche, hears the ruckus and comes into the changing room. She takes the opposite tack from me. Joey may throw fits all the time at home, but at the creche, it's quite unusual. Fatima leans into Joey and starts stroking his forehead.
"What is it?"
she keeps asking him gently. She views this tantrum not as some abstract, inevitable expression of the terrible twos, but as communication from a very small, blonde, rational being. After a minute or two, Joey calms down enough to explain, through words and gestures, that he wants his hat from his locker. That's what this whole scene had been about. I think he tried to grab it earlier. Fatima takes Joey down from the changing table, then watches as he goes to the locker, opens it, and takes out the hat. After that, he's sage and ready to go. Fatima isn't a pushover. She has a lot of authority with the kids. She didn't think that just because she patiently listened to Joey, she was giving in to him. She just calmed him down, then gave him a chance to express what he wanted. Unfortunately, there are endless scenarios, and no one rule about what to do in every case. The French have a whole bunch of contradictory principles, and few hard and fast rules. Sometimes you listen carefully to your kid, and sometimes you just put him on the scale. It's about setting limits, but also about observing your child, building complicity, and then adapting to what the situation requires. For some parents, all this probably becomes automatic. But for now, I wonder if this balance will ever come naturally to me. It feels like the difference between trying to learn salsa dancing as a 30-year-old and growing up dancing salsa as a child with your dad. I'm still counting steps and stepping on toes. In some American homes I visited, it's not uncommon for a child to be sent to his room during practically every meal. In France, there are lots of small reminders about how to behave, but being puni, punished, is a big deal. Often parents send the punished child to his room or to a corner. Sometimes they spank him. I've seen French kids spanked in public only a few times, though friends of mine in Paris say they see it more frequently. At a staging of Goldilocks and the Three Bears, the actress playing Mommy Bear asks the audience what should happen to the baby bear, who's been acting up.
La fessée!
A spanking. The crowd of little kids shouts in unison. In a national poll, 19% of French parents said they spank their kids from time to time, 46% said they spank rarely, and 2% said they spank often. Another 33% said they never spank their kids. In the past, la fessée probably played a bigger role in French child-rearing and in enforcing adults' authority, but the tide is turning. All the French parenting experts I read about oppose it. Instead of spanking, they recommend that parents become adept at saying no. Like Marcelli, they say that no should be used sparingly, but once uttered, it must be definitive. This idea isn't new. In fact, it comes all the way from Rousseau. Give willingly, refuse unwillingly, he writes in Emile. But let your refusal be irrevocable. Let no entreaties move you. Let your no, once uttered, be a wall of brass against which the child may exhaust his strength some 5 or 6 times. But in the end, he will try no more to overthrow it. Thus you will make him patient, equable, calm, and resigned, even when he does not get all he wants. In addition to the rapid movement gene, Leo has also been born with the subversive gene.
I want water, he announces at dinner one night.
What's the magic word? I ask sweetly.
Water,
he says, smirking. Strangely, Leo, who looks the most like Simon, speaks with a slight British accent. Joey and Bean both sound American. Building a cadre for your kids is a lot of work. In the early years, it requires much repetition and attention, but once it's in place, it makes life much easier and calmer, or so it seems. In moments of desperation, I start telling my kids in French, C'est moi qui décide. It's me who decides. Just uttering this sentence is strangely fortifying. My back stiffens a bit when I say it. The French way also requires a paradigm shift. I'm so used to believing that everything revolves around the kids. Being more French means moving the center of gravity away from them and letting my own needs spread out a bit, too. Feeling like I have some control also makes having 3 little kids a lot more manageable. When Simon is traveling one spring weekend, I let the kids drag carpets and blankets out on our balcony and create a kind of Moroccan lounge. I bring them hot chocolate, and they sit around sipping it. When I tell Simon about this later, he immediately asks, "Wasn't it stressful?" It probably would have been a few weeks earlier. I'd have felt overpowered by them or too worried to enjoy it. There would have been shouting, which, since our balcony overlooks the courtyard, our neighbors would have heard. But now that I'm the decider, at least a little bit, having 3 kids on the balcony with hot chocolate actually feels manageable. I even sit down and have a cup of coffee with them. One morning I'm taking Leo to creche by himself. Simon and I have divided the morning duties. As I'm riding down the elevator with Leo, I feel a sense of dread. I decide to tell him firmly that there will be no shouting in the courtyard. I present this new rule as if it has always existed. I explain it firmly, while looking into Leo's eyes. I ask him whether he understands, and then pause to give him a chance to reply. After a thoughtful moment, he says yes. When we open the glass door and walk out into the courtyard, it's silent. There's no shouting or whining. There's just a very speedy little boy tugging me along. Chapter 14. Let him live his life. One day, a notice goes up at Bean School. It says that parents of students ages 4 to 11 can register their kids for a summer trip to the Haute-Vosges, a rural region about 5 hours by car from Paris. The trip, sans parents, will last for 8 days. I can't imagine sending Bean, who's 5, on an 8-day school holiday. She's never even spent more than a night alone at my mother's house. My own first overnight class trip to SeaWorld was when I was in junior high. This trip is yet another reminder that while I can now use the subjunctive in French and even get my kids to listen to me, I'll never actually be French. Being French means looking at a notice like this and saying, as the mother of another 5-year-old next to me does, "What a shame! We already have plans then." None of the French parents find the idea of dispatching their 4- and 5-year-olds for a week of group showers and dormitory life to be at all alarming. I soon discover that this school trip is just the beginning. I didn't go to sleepaway camp until I was 10 or 11. But in France, there are hundreds of different sleepaway colonies de vacances, vacation colonies, for kids as young as 4. The younger kids typically go away for 7 or 8 days to the countryside, where they ride ponies, feed goats, learn songs, and discover nature. For older kids, there are colonies that specialize in things like theater, kayaking, or astronomy. It's clear that giving kids a degree of independence and stressing a kind of inner resilience and self-reliance is a big part of French parenting. The French call this autonomie, autonomy. They generally aim to give children as much autonomy as they can handle. This includes physical autonomy, like the class trips. It also includes emotional separation, like letting them build their own self-esteem that doesn't depend on praise from parents and other adults. I admire a lot about French parenting. I've tried to absorb the French way of eating, of wielding authority, and of teaching my kids to entertain themselves. I've started speaking at length to babies and letting my kids just discover things for themselves instead of pushing them to acquire skills. In moments of crisis and confusion, I often find myself asking, what would a French mother do? But I have a harder time accepting certain parts of the French emphasis on autonomy, like the school trips. Of course, I don't want my kids to be too dependent on me, but what's the rush? Must the push for autonomy start so young? And aren't the French overdoing it a bit? In some cases, the drive to make kids self-reliant seems to clash with my most basic instincts to protect my kids and to make them feel good. American parents tend to dole out independence quite differently. It's only after I marry Simon, a European, that I realize I spent much of my childhood acquiring survival skills. You wouldn't know it from looking at me, but I can shoot a bow and arrow, right a capsized canoe, safely build a fire on someone's stomach, and, while treading water, convert a pair of blue jeans into an inflated life jacket. As a European, Simon didn't have this survivalist upbringing. He never learned how to pitch a tent or steer a kayak. He'd be hard-pressed to know which end of a sleeping bag to crawl into. In the wild, he'd survive about 15 minutes, and that's only if he had a book. The irony is, while I have all these faux pioneering skills, I learned them in tightly scheduled summer camps after my parents had signed disclaimers drawn up by lawyers in case I drowned. And that was before there were webcams and classrooms and vegan, nut-free birthday cakes. Despite their scouting badges and killer back hands, middle-class American kids are famously quite protected. The current trend in parenting is to shield children from emotional or physical discomfort, the American psychologist Wendy Mogul writes in The Blessing of a Skinned Knee. Instead of giving kids freedom, the well-heeled parents, Mogul counsels, try to armor their kids with a thick layer of skills by giving them lots of lessons and pressuring them to compete and excel. It's not simply that Americans don't emphasize autonomy. It's that we're not sure it's a good thing. We tend to assume that parents should be physically present as much as possible to protect kids from harm and to smooth out emotional turbulence for them. Simon and I have joked since Bean was born that we'll just move with her to wherever she attends college. Then I see an article saying that some American colleges now hold parting ceremonies for the parents of incoming freshmen to signal that the parents need to leave. French parents don't seem to have this fantasy of control. They want to protect their kids, but they aren't obsessed with far-flung eventualities. When they're traveling, they don't, as I do, email their husband once a day to remind him to bolt the front door and to make sure that all the toilet lids are closed so a child can't fall in. In France, the social pressure goes in the opposite direction. If a parent hovers too much or seems to micromanage his child's experiences, someone else is apt to urge him to back off. My friend Sharon, the literary agent with two kids, explains. Here there's an argument about pushing a child to the max. Everyone will say, you have to let children live their lives. The French emphasis on autonomy comes all the way from Françoise Dolto. The most important thing is that a child will be in full security, autonomous as early as possible, Dolto says in the major stages of childhood. The trap of the relationship between parents and children is not recognizing the true needs of the child, of which freedom is one. The child has the need to feel loved in what he is becoming, sure of himself in a space, day by day more freely left to his own exploration, to his personal experience, and in his relations with those of his own age. Dotto is talking, in part, about leaving a child alone, safely, to figure things out for himself, She also means respecting him as a separate being who can cope with challenges. In Dolto's view, by the time a child is 6 years old, he should be able to do everything in the house and in society that concerns him. The French way can be tough for even the most integrated Americans to accept. My friend Andy, an artist who's lived in France for more than 20 years, says that when her older son was 6, she found out that he had an upcoming class trip. Everyone tells you how great it is, because in April, there'll be a classe verte, literally a green class. And you say to yourself, what's that? Oh, a field trip. And it's a week? It lasts a week? At her son's school, the trips are optional until first grade. After that, the whole class of 25 kids is expected to go on a week-long trip with a teacher each spring. Andy says that by American standards, she isn't a particularly clingy mother. However, she couldn't get comfortable with the green class, which was to be held near some salt marshes off the western coast of France. Her son had never even gone on a sleepover. Andy still corralled him into the shower each night. She couldn't imagine him going to bed without her tucking him in. She liked his teacher, but she didn't know the other adults who'd be supervising the trip. One was the teacher's nephew. Another was a supervisor from the playground. The third, Andy recalls, was just this other person the teacher knows. When Andy told her three sisters in the United States about the trip, they completely freaked out. They said, "You don't have to do that." One's a lawyer, and she's like, "Did you sign anything?" Andy says they were mainly worried about pedophiles. At an informational meeting about the trip, another American mom from the class asked the teacher how she would cope with a scenario in which an electrical wire accidentally fell in the water and a child then walked into the water. Andy says the French parents snickered. She was relieved that she hadn't asked the question, but she admits that it reflected her own hidden neuroses. Andy's own main concern, which she didn't dare raise at the meeting, was what would happen if her son became sad or upset during the trip. When this happens at home, I tried to help him identify his emotions. If he started crying and he didn't know why, I would say, "Are you scared? Frustrated? Are you angry?" That was my thing. I was like, "Okay, we're going to go through this together." The French emphasis on autonomy extends beyond school trips. My heart regularly jumps when I'm walking around my neighborhood because French parents will often let small kids race ahead of them on the sidewalk. They trust that the kids will stop at the corner and wait for them. Watching this is particularly terrifying when the kids are on scooters. I live in a world of worst-case scenarios. When I run into my friend Alain on the street and we stop to chat, she lets her three girls wander off a bit toward the edge of the sidewalk. She trusts that they won't suddenly dash into the street. Bean probably wouldn't do that either, but just in case, I make her stand next to me and hold my hand. Simon reminds me that I once wouldn't let Bean sit in the stands to watch him play soccer, in case she got hit by the ball. There are many small moments in France when I'd expect to help my kids along, but they're supposed to go it alone. By accident, I often run into the caregivers from the boys' creche, leading a group of toddlers down the street to buy the day's baguettes. It's not an official outing. It's just taking a few kids for a walk. Bean has been on school trips to the zoo or to a big park on the outskirts of Paris, which I learn about only by accident weeks later when I happen to take her to the same zoo. I am rarely asked to sign waivers. French parents don't seem to worry that anything untoward might be happening on these trips. When Bean has a recital for a dance class, I'm not even allowed backstage. I make sure she has a pair of white leggings, which is the only instruction that's been communicated to parents. I never speak to the teacher. Her relationship is with Bean, not with me. When we get to the theater, I just hand Bean over to an assistant, who shuttles her backstage. For weeks, Bean has been telling me, "I don't want to be a marionette." I wasn't sure what that meant, but it becomes clear as soon as the curtains open. Bean comes on stage in full costume and makeup, with a dozen other little girls, doing deliberately jolty arm and leg movements to a song called Marionetta. Not deliberately, the girls are way out of sync with each other. They look like escaped marionettes who've had too much cognac. But it's clear that Bean, without my knowledge, has memorized an entire 10-minute dance routine. When she comes out from backstage after the show, I gush about what a wonderful job she did, but she looks disappointed.
I forgot to not be a marionette, she says.
French kids aren't just more independent in their extracurricular activities. They also have more autonomy in their dealings with each other. French parents seem slower to intervene in playground disputes or to mediate arguments between siblings. They expect kids to work these situations out for themselves. French schoolyards are famously free-for-alls, with teachers mostly watching from the sidelines. When I pick up Bean from preschool one afternoon, she has just come from the schoolyard and has a red gash on her cheek. It's not deep, but it's bleeding. She won't tell me what happened, though she doesn't seem concerned and she isn't in pain. Her teacher claims not to know what happened. I'm practically in tears by the time I question the director of the school, but she doesn't know anything about it either. They all seem surprised that I'm making such a fuss. My mother happens to be visiting, and she can't believe this nonchalance. She says that a similar injury in America would prompt official inquiries, calls home, and lengthy explanations. For French parents, such events are upsetting, but they aren't Shakespearean tragedies.
In France, we like it when kids brawl a bit, the journalist and author Audrey Guttard tells me. It's a part of us as a bit French and a bit Mediterranean. We like that our children know how to defend their territory and quarrel a bit with other children. We're not bothered by a certain violence between children.
Bean's reluctance to say how she got the gash probably reflects another aspect of the autonomy ethos. Telling on another child, known in French as rapporter contre, is viewed very badly. People theorize that this is because of all the lethal informing on neighbors that went on during World War II. At the annual meeting of my apartment's building association, many of whose members were alive during the war, I ask if anyone knows who's been tipping over our stroller in the lobby.
We don't rapporter,
an older woman says. Everyone laughs. Americans don't like tattletales either. However, in France, even among kids, having the inner resolve to suffer some scrapes and keep your lips sealed is considered a life skill. Even within families, people are entitled to their secrets.
I can have secrets with my son that he can't tell his mother,
Mark, the French golfer, tells me. I see a French movie in which a well-known economist picks up his teenage daughter at a Parisian police station after she's been brought in for shoplifting and possessing marijuana. On the drive home, she defends herself by saying that at least she didn't rat on the friend who was with her. This don't-tell culture creates solidarity among kids. They learn to rely on one another and on themselves, rather than rushing to parents or school authorities for backup. There certainly isn't the same reverence for truth at any cost. Mark and his American wife, Robin, tell me about a recent case in which their son, Adrian, who's now 10, saw another student setting off firecrackers at school. There was a big inquiry. Robin urged Adrian to tell the school authorities what he'd seen. Mark advised him to consider the other boy's popularity and whether he could beat Adrian up.
You have to calculate the risks, Mark says. If the advantage is not to do anything, he should do nothing. I want my son to analyze things.
I see this emphasis on making kids learn their own lessons when I'm renovating our apartment. Like all the American parents I know, I'm eager for everything to be rigorously childproof. I choose rubber flooring for the kids' bathroom, lest they slip on wet tile. I also insist that every appliance has a kid-proof lock, and that the oven door is a type that doesn't get hot. My contractor, Regis, an earthy, roguish fellow from Burgundy, thinks I'm nuts. He says the way to childproof an oven is to let the kid touch it once and realize that it's hot. Regis refuses to install rubber floors in the bathroom, saying that they would look terrible. I concede, but only when he also mentions the apartment's resale value. I don't budge on the oven. On the day that I read an English story to Bean's class at Maternelle, the teacher gives a brief English lesson beforehand. She points to a pen and asks the kids to say the pen's color in English. In response, a 4-year-old boy says something about his shoes.
That has nothing to do with the question, the teacher tells him.
I'm taken aback by this response. I would have expected the teacher to find something positive to say, no matter how far off the subject the answer is. I come from the American tradition of, as the sociologist Annette Laroux describes it, treating each child's thought as a special contribution. By crediting kids for even the most irrelevant comments, we try to give them confidence and make them feel good about themselves. In France, that kind of parenting is very conspicuous. I see this when I take the kids to the in-ground trampolines in the Tuileries Gardens, next to the Louvre. Each child jumps on his own trampoline inside a gated area while parents watch from the surrounding benches, but one mom has brought a chair inside the gates and parked it directly in front of her son's trampoline. She shouts, "Whoa!" each time he jumps. I know, even before I approach to eavesdrop further, that she must be an Anglophone like me. I know this because although I manage to restrain myself at the trampolines, I feel compelled to say, "Wee!" each time one of my kids goes down a slide. This is shorthand for, "I see you doing this. I approve. You're wonderful." Likewise, I praise even their worst drawings and artwork. I feel that I must to boost their self-esteem. French parents also want their kids to feel good about themselves and bien dans leur peau, comfortable in their own skin. But they have a different strategy for bringing this about. It's in some ways the opposite of the American strategy. They don't believe that praise is always good. The French believe that kids feel confident when they're able to do things for themselves and do those things well. After children have learned to talk, adults don't praise them for saying just anything. They praise them for saying interesting things and for speaking well. Sociologist Raymond Carrel says French parents want to teach their children to verbally defend themselves well. She quotes an informant who says, "In France, if the child has something to say, others listen to him. But the child can't take too much time and still retain his audience. If he delays, the family finishes his sentences for him. This gets him in the habit of formulating his ideas better before he speaks. Children learn to speak quickly and to be interesting." Even when French kids do say interesting things, or just give the correct answer, French adults are decidedly understated in response. They don't act like every job well done is an occasion to say, "Good job." When I take Bean to the free health clinic for a checkup, the pediatrician asks her to do a wooden puzzle. Bean does it. The doctor looks at the finished puzzle and then does something I'm not constitutionally capable of, practically nothing. She mutters the faintest, "Bon," more of a "let's move on" than a "good," then proceeds with the checkup. Not only don't teachers and authority figures in France routinely praise children to their faces, but, to my great disappointment, they also don't routinely praise children to their parents. I had hoped this was a quirk of Bean's rather sullen first-year teacher. The following year, she has two alternating teachers. One is a dynamic, extremely warm young woman named Marina, with whom Bean has an excellent rapport. But when I ask Marina how things are going, she says that Bean is très compétente. I type this into Google Translate to make sure I haven't missed some nuance of compétente that might suggest brilliance. It just means competent. It's good that my expectations are low when Simon and I have a mid-semester meeting with Agnès, Bean's other teacher. She, too, is lovely and attentive. And yet she also seems reluctant to label Bean or make any general statements about her. She simply says, "Everything is fine." Then she shows us the one worksheet out of dozens that Bean had trouble finishing. I leave the meeting having no idea of how Bean ranks against her peers. After the meeting, I'm miffed that Agnès didn't mention anything that Bean has done well. Simon points out that in France, that's not a teacher's job. Rather, Agnès's role is to discover problems. If the child is struggling, the parents need to know. If the child is coping, there is nothing more to say. This focus on the negative, rather than on trying to boost kids' and parents' morales with positive reinforcement, is a well-known and often criticized feature of French schools. It's almost impossible to get a perfect score on the French baccalauréat, the final exams at the end of high school. A score of 14-20, 14 out of a possible 20, is considered excellent, and 16-20 is almost like getting a perfect score. Through friends, I meet Benoit, who's a father of two and a professor at one of France's elite universities. Benoit says his high school-age son is an excellent student. However, the most positive comment a teacher ever wrote on one of his papers was, des qualités, some good qualities. Benoit says French teachers don't grade their students on a curve, but rather against an ideal, which practically no one meets. Even for an outstanding paper, the French way would be to say correct, not too bad, but this and this and this and this are wrong. By high school, Benoit says there's little value placed on letting students express their feelings and opinions. If you say I love this poem because it makes me think of certain experiences I had, that's completely wrong. What you're taught in high school is to learn to reason. You're not supposed to be creative. You're supposed to be articulate. When Benoit took a temporary posting at Princeton, he was surprised when students accused him of being a harsh grader. I learned that you have to say some positive things about even the worst essays, he recalls. In one incident, he had to justify giving a student a D. Conversely, I hear that an American who taught at a French high school got complaints from parents when she gave grades of 18 out of 20 and 20 out of 20. The parents assumed that the class was too easy and that the grades were fake. All this criticism can intimidate kids. A girlfriend of mine who went to French schools until she moved to Chicago for high school remembers being shocked by how American students spoke up confidently in class. She says that unlike in her French schools, students weren't immediately criticized for being wrong or for asking dumb questions. Another friend, a French physician who lives in Paris, tells me excitedly about the new yoga class she's taking, taught by an American woman. She keeps telling me how well I'm doing and how beautiful I am, she says of the teacher. In her many years of French schooling, my friend had probably never gotten so much praise. In general, the French parents I know are a lot more supportive than French teachers. They do praise their kids and give them positive reinforcement. Even so, they don't slather on praise the way we Americans do. I'm starting to suspect that French parents may be right in giving less praise. Perhaps they realize that those little zaps of pleasure kids get each time a grown-up says, good job, could, if they arrive too often, simply make kids addicted to positive feedback. After a while, they'll need someone else's approval to feel good about themselves. And if kids are assured of praise for whatever they do, then they won't need to try very hard. They'll be praised anyway. Since I'm American, what really convinces me is the research. Praise seems to be yet another realm in which French parents are doing, through tradition and intuition, what the latest scientific studies suggest. In their 2009 book, Nurture Shock, Poe Bronson and Ashley Merriman write that the old conventional wisdom that praise, self-esteem, and performance rise and fall together has been toppled by new research showing that excessive praise distorts children's motivations. They begin doing things merely to hear the praise, losing sight of the intrinsic enjoyment. Bronson and Merriman point to research showing that when heavily praised students get to college, they become risk-averse and lack perceived autonomy. These students commonly drop out of classes rather than suffer a mediocre grade, and they have a hard time picking a major. They're afraid to commit to something because they're afraid of not succeeding. This research also refutes the conventional American wisdom that when kids fail at something, parents should cushion the blow with positive feedback. A better tack is to gently delve into what went wrong, giving kids the confidence and the tools to improve. French schools may be a bit harsh, especially in the later years, but this is exactly what Bean's French teachers were doing, and it certainly reflects what French parents believe. The French seem to proceed through parenting using a kind of scientific method to test what works and what doesn't. In general, they are unmoved by ideas about what should work on their kids and clear-sighted about what actually does work. What they conclude is that some praise is good for a child, but that if you praise her too much, you're not letting her live her life. Over the winter holidays, I bring Bean back to the United States. At a family gathering, she starts putting on a one-child show, which mostly involves acting like a teacher and giving the grown-ups orders. It's cute, but frankly, not brilliant. Yet gradually, every adult in the room stops to watch and to remark on how adorable Bean is. She wisely drops in some French phrases and songs, knowing that these always impress. By the time the show is over, Bean is beaming as she soaks up all the praise. I think it's the highlight of her visit. I'm beaming, too. I interpret the praise for her as praise for me, which I've been starving for in France. All through dinner afterward, everyone talks, within earshot of both of us, about how terrific the show was. This is great on vacation, but I'm not sure I'd want Bean to get that kind of unconditional praise all the time. It feels good, but it seems to come bundled with other things, including letting a child constantly interrupt because she's bursting with a sense of her own importance. It might also throw off Bean's internal calibration of what's truly entertaining and what's not. I've accepted that if we stay in France, my kids probably won't ever learn to shoot a bow and arrow. God forbid they're ever attacked by 18th century American Indians. I've even toned down my praise a bit. But adjusting to the overarching French view on autonomy is a lot harder. Of course I know that my children have an emotional life that's separate from mine, and that I can't constantly protect them from rejection and disappointment. Nevertheless, the idea that they have their lives and I have mine doesn't reflect my emotional map, or maybe it just doesn't suit my emotional needs. Still, I have to admit that my kids seem happiest when I trust them to do things for themselves. I don't hand them knives and tell them to go carve a watermelon. They mostly know when things are way beyond their abilities, but I do let them stretch a bit, even if it's just to carry a breakable plate to the dinner table. After these small achievements, they're calmer and happier. Dolto is most certainly right that autonomy is one of a child's most basic needs. She also may be right about age 6 being the threshold. One night, I'm sick with the flu and keeping Simon awake with my coughing. I retreat to the couch in the middle of the night. When the kids march into the living room at about 7:30 a.m., I can hardly move. I don't start my usual routine of putting out breakfast. So Bean does. I lie on the couch, still wearing my eye shades. In the background, I hear her opening drawers, setting the table, and getting out the milk and cereal. She's 5.5 years old, and she's taken my job. She's even subcontracted some of it to Joey, who's organizing the silverware. After a few minutes, Bean comes over to me on the couch.
"Breakfast is ready, but you have to do the coffee," she says.
She's calm and very pleased. I'm struck by how happy, or more specifically, how sage being autonomous makes her feel. I haven't praised or encouraged her. She's just done something new for herself with me as a witness and is feeling very good about it. Dolto's idea that I should trust my children and that trusting and respecting them will make them trust and respect me is very appealing. In fact, it's a relief. The clutch of mutual dependency and worry that often seems to bind American parents to their kids feels inevitable at times, but it never feels good. It doesn't seem like the basis for the best parenting. Letting children live their lives isn't about releasing them into the wild or abandoning them, though French school trips do feel a bit like that to me. It's about acknowledging that children aren't repositories for their parents' ambitions or projects for their parents to perfect. They are separate and capable, with their own tastes, pleasures, and experiences of the world. They even have their own secrets. My friend Andy ended up letting her older son go on that trip to the salt marshes. She says he loved it. It seems he didn't need to be tucked in every night. It was Andy who needed to do the tucking. When it was time for Andy's younger son to start taking the same class trips, she just let him go. Maybe I'll get used to these trips, though I haven't signed up Bean for one yet. My friend Esther proposes that we send our daughters off together to a colonie de vacances next summer, when they'll be 6 years old. I find this hard to imagine. I want my kids to be self-reliant, resilient, and happy. I just don't want to let go of their hands. The future in French. My mother has finally accepted that we live across an ocean from her. She's even studying French, though it's not going as well as she'd like. An American friend of hers, who lived in Panama but spoke little Spanish, suggests a technique. Say a Spanish sentence in the present tense, then shout the name of the intended tense. I go to the store, pasado, means that she went to the store. I go to the store, futuro, means that she'll go later. I forbid my mother to do this when she comes to visit. To my astonishment, I now have a reputation to protect. I have 3 kids in the local school and courteous relations with neighborhood fishmongers, tailors, and cafe proprietors. Paris finally cares that I'm here. I still haven't swooned for the city. I get tired of the elaborate exchanges of bonjour and of using the distancing vous with everyone but colleagues and intimates. Living in France feels a bit too formal and doesn't bring out my freewheeling side. I realize how much I've changed when on the metro one morning I instinctively back away from the man sitting next to the only empty seat because I have the impression that he's deranged. On reflection, I realize my only evidence for this is that he's wearing shorts. Nevertheless, Paris has come to feel like home. As the French say, I've found my place. It helps that I've made some wonderful friends. It turns out that behind their icy facades, Parisian women need to mirror and bond, too. They're even hiding a bit of cellulite. These friendships have turned me into a bona fide francophone. I'm often surprised, mid-conversation, to hear coherent French sentences coming out of my own mouth. It's also exciting watching my kids become bilingual. One morning as I'm getting dressed, Leo points to my brassiere. "What's that?" he asks. "A bra," I say. He immediately points to his arm. It takes me a second to understand. The French word bras, with a silent S, means arm. He must have learned this word at his crèche. I quiz him and discover that he knows most of the other main body parts in French, too. What has really connected me to France is discovering the wisdom of French parenting. I've learned that children are capable of feats of self-reliance and mindful behavior that, as an American parent, I might never have imagined. I can't go back to not knowing this, even if we end up living elsewhere. Of course, some French principles are easier to implement when you're actually on French soil. When other children aren't having midday snacks at the playground, it's easier not to give your child a snack either. It's also easier to enforce boundaries for your own kid's behavior when everyone around you is enforcing more or less the same boundaries. Or, as I often ask Bean, do they let you do this in school? But much about French parenting doesn't depend on where you live or require access to certain types of cheese. It's as accessible in Cleveland as in Cannes. It mostly requires a parent to shift how she conceives of her relationship to her children and what she expects from them. Friends often ask whether I'm raising my kids to be more French or more American. When I'm with them in public, I usually think they're somewhere in between badly behaved compared with the French kids I know and pretty good compared with the Americans. They don't always say bonjour and au revoir, but they know that they're supposed to. Like a real French mother, I'm always reminding them of it. I've come to see this as part of an ongoing process called their éducation, in which they increasingly learn to respect other people and learn to wait. This éducation seems to be gradually sinking in. I'm still striving for that French ideal, genuinely listening to my kids, but not feeling that I must bend to their wills. I still declare, "It's me who decides," in moments of crisis, to remind everyone that I'm in charge. I see it as my job to stop my kids from being consumed by their own desires, but I also try to say yes as often as I can. Simon and I have stopped discussing whether we'll stay in France. If we do, I'm not sure what's in store as our children get older. By the time French kids become teenagers, their parents seem to give them quite a lot of freedom and to be matter-of-fact about their having private lives and even sex lives. Perhaps that gives the teenagers less reason to rebel. French teenagers seem to have an easier time accepting that maman and papa have private lives too. After all, the parents have always acted as if they do. They haven't based life entirely around their children. French kids do plan to move out of their parents' homes eventually. But if a Frenchman in his 20s still lives with his parents, it isn't quite the humiliating tragedy that it is in America. They can let each other live their lives. The summer before Bean starts kindergarten, I realize that the French way of parenting has really gotten under my skin. Practically all of her French friends are spending weeks of their summer vacations with their grandparents. I decide that we should send Bean to stay in Miami with my mother. My mom will be visiting us in Paris anyway, so they can fly back together. Simon is against it. What if Bean gets madly homesick and we're an ocean away? I found a day camp with daily swimming lessons. Because of the timing, she'll have to start the camp mid-session. Won't it be difficult for her to make friends? He suggests we wait a year, until she's older. But Bean thinks the trip is a spectacular idea. She says she'll be fine alone with her grandmother, and that she's excited about the camp. Simon finally acquiesces, perhaps calculating that with Bean away, he'll get to spend more time in cafes. I'll fly to Miami to bring her home. I give my mother just a few instructions. No pork, lots of sunblock. Bean and I spend a week fine-tuning the contents of her carry-on bag for the airplane. We have a moment of melancholy when I promise to call every day. And I do. But as soon as Bean arrives in Miami, she is so absorbed in her adventure that she won't stay on the phone for more than a minute or two. I rely on reports from my mom and her friends. One of them writes in an email to me, "She ate sushi with us tonight, taught us some French, told us about some pressing issues concerning her friends from school, and went off to bed with a smile on her face." After just a few days, Bean's English, which was once mid-Atlantic mysterious with a British twist, now sounds almost fully American. She says car with a full flat R. However, she's definitely milking her status as an expatriate. My mom says they listened to her language tapes in the car and that Bean declared, "That man doesn't know French." Bean does try to figure out what's happened in Paris while she was away.
"Is Daddy fat? Is Mommy old?"
she asks us after about a week. My mom says Bean keeps telling people when I'll arrive in Miami, how long I'll stay, and where we'll go after that. Just as Françoise Dolto predicted, she needs both independence and a rational understanding of the world. When I tell friends about Bean's trip, their reactions split straight down national lines. The North Americans say that Bean is brave and ask how she's coping with the separation. None are sending kids her age off for 10-day stints with their grandparents, especially not across an ocean. But my French friends assume that detaching a bit is good for everyone. They take for granted that Bean is having fun on her own and that I'm enjoying a well-deserved break. As the kids become more independent, Simon and I are getting along better. He's still irritable, and I'm still irritating. But he's decided that it's okay to be cheerful sometimes, and to admit that he enjoys my company. Every once in a while, he even laughs at my jokes. Weirdly, he seems to find Bean's sense of humor hilarious. "When you were born, I thought you were a monkey," he tells her playfully one morning.
"Well, when you were born, I thought you were a caca," she replies.
Simon laughs so hard at this, he's practically in tears. It seems I've just never hit on his preferred category of humor, scatological surrealism. I haven't started making potty jokes, but I have made other concessions. I micromanage Simon less, even when I come out in the morning and he's serving the kids unshaken orange juice. I figured out that, like them, he craves autonomy. If that means a glassful of pulp for me, so be it. I no longer ask what he's thinking about. I've learned to cultivate and appreciate having some mystery in our marriage. Last summer, we went back to the seaside town where I first noticed all those French children eating happily in restaurants. This time, instead of having one child with us, we have three. And instead of trying to manage in a hotel, we wisely rent a house with a kitchen. One afternoon, we take the kids out for lunch at a restaurant near the port. It's one of those idyllic French summer days when whitewashed buildings glow in the midday sun. And strangely, all five of us are able to enjoy it. We order our food calmly and in courses. The kids stay in their seats and enjoy their food, including some fish and vegetables. Nothing lands on the floor. I have to do a bit of gentle coaching. It's not as relaxing as dining out alone with Simon, but it really does feel like we're on vacation. We even have coffee at the end of the meal. This is Abby Craden. We hope you have enjoyed this unabridged production of Bringing Up Bébé, One American Mother Discovers the Wisdom of French Parenting by Pamela Druckerman. This program was directed by Susan Nizami. Executive producer, Kelly Gilday. Text copyright, 2012, by Pamela Druckerman. Production copyright, 2012, Random House, Inc. All rights reserved.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.